this show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening around the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervie, and I am the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. And today I'm here to be the managing partner of your life. And with me, of course, is my beautiful and talented co-host, Carrie Kasem.
I'm here.
We missed you last week at the show.
The show was good. Listen to that.
Yeah, was last week. Did you hear LeVar Ball? Wow. You know, it's so funny because he's my new best friend. We had a bromance. What a great show. And, you know, I think we will be hanging out together. He really wants to have milk and cookies with me.
Yeah, I'm sure of
it. I think he said that I was like the most intelligent guy he'd ever spoken to on the radio or on TV. In the media.
I will second that, because sometimes I definitely believe you're one of the smartest people I've ever met, but sometimes so smart that I don't understand half the stuff that's coming out of your mouth.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but I'll tell you, I did have, I believe, a success this past week when I argued in the Court of Appeal on a very important case in the state of California for all injured workers. Hopefully I will win. We haven't heard yet. They have 60 days to provide an opinion, but if I am successful, then I think everyone in the state of California will benefit, at least those who have been injured, and their rights will be protected if we shall prevail. So last week was an exciting week. I spoke to LeVar Ball, had an opportunity to talk to him about motivating people, and then I went and motivated myself and answered questions, argued before the Court of Appeal, which went very well.
It's, congratulations.
It's kind of intimidating. I mean, it's not the Supreme Court of the United States, but it is the Court of Appeal, so it's modeled after the same techniques of questions and answers. You stand before, in this case, it was three justices, and they were peppering me with questions. Actually, they weren't, but one of the justices was very, very well informed, and she did a great job of asking, I thought, relevant and germane questions, and hopefully I was able to provide the answers to her satisfaction. So we're looking forward to getting a decision on that important case in workers' compensation in the state of California. As far as LeVar Ball goes, I'm looking forward to hanging out with him, having some milk and cookies, and enjoying, you know, just our bromance. We have a great show today. I'm really excited, Carrie, because we are going to have an incredible debate between two sides of the spectrum. But this isn't just a debate of politics. This is the most scholarly people around. It's, first of all, Erwin Chemerinsky, who is the new dean of the Berkeley Law School. He's leaving UCI as the dean of the UCI School of Law, and he is moving up to Berkeley. He is going to discuss the issues of the day in Supreme Court cases, very important Supreme Court cases, with John Eastman. Professor John Eastman is the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service, and he's the former dean at Chapman University School of Law in Orange, California, just down the road from Professor Chemerinsky's former school, UC Irvine School of Law. So, Carrie, stay tuned. I'm so glad you're here with us today. For Professor Chemerinsky and Professor Eastman, after the break.
Cars, trucks, motorcycles. If it's got a motor, we've got your man. If there was ever a time you needed an automotive expert like Leon Kaplan at your side, it's now. The Motor Man. Sunday mornings at 8 on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Stremix Heritage Foods is committed to three core values: local, fresh, and family. The Stremix family comes to work every day so that your family enjoys certified organic milk that is produced without the use of growth hormones, non-GMO, and produced locally in Santa Ana, California. And local means fresher. Stremix Heritage organic milk goes from the field to carton within days. Stremix is proud to put the family name on every carton and even prouder to earn your family's trust every day. Look in your favorite grocer's dairy case today.
Attention, this is an investor notice. Are you interested in making some extra cash buying real estate tax liens? Then listen to this. The Government Tax Lien Network is offering a free tax lien kit, which contains two DVDs and a step-by-step report that will show you how to earn guaranteed returns between 15 and 35% yearly, which is completely secured by the government. They'll even show you how to do this inside your own retirement accounts. So if you're looking to become a real estate investor without risk, then call 1-800-613-8830 now to get your free tax lien kit. Then get ready to buy tax liens for pennies on the dollar and buy houses for as low as $500, all from your home, with little or no money, working only 5 to 10 hours per week. Call 800-613-8830 right now to get your free tax lien kit, plus two free tickets to a live training event and a free $20 Visa gift card just for attending. Call 800-613-8830. That's 800-613-8830 for your free tax lien kit now. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Leanne Tweeden here. The days are getting longer, warmer, and summer's pretty much here. It's that time when everyone and everything goes crazy. And that's what happened to my sewer line. 3 hours before a dinner party, it clogged and water backed up into the sinks. Fortunately, I knew who to call. SoCal Plumbers 911, the referral service for the very best plumbers. And here's how to get in touch. Go to SoCalPlumbers911.com or call 877-PLUMBER. They're offering $50 off your entire bill just to try them out. For any plumbing problem, remember SoCalPlumbers911.com or 877-PLUMBER.
Hey, what is it?
You know what it is. 97, 97, 97, 97, 97.
KABC.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yes, we are back. I'm Alan Gervie. You're listening to Gervie's Law. I'm here with my co-host Terry Kasem. And we are going to have a really exciting show today because a lot of people are not sure where they fall on some of these issues. You're going to have an opportunity to really hear from the experts, the scholars, Professor Erwin Chemerinsky and Professor John Eastman. John Eastman will be joining us shortly, but before he does, we have to have a few words with our old buddy, Dean, founding Dean of the University of California Irvine School of Law. And we have to wish him a congratulations because he is now the dean and will be the dean of the University of California Berkeley School of Law, Professor Chemerinsky. Welcome to Gervie's Law.
Can you hear me? Yes.
I can hear you there. You're loud and clear.
I was just saying thank you so much for your kind words.
Oh, no problem. You know, I have to tell you that sometimes we do have to take a moment to pause and look at our careers and decide where we want to be. And apparently you had that opportunity most recently when you were chosen as the new dean of the School of Law at Berkeley. We used to call it the Bolt School of Law, but I don't think they like to call it that anymore. I don't want to tell you anything out of school here, but apparently they spent $25,000 and had a consultant come in, and they said that when you call it Bolt School of Law, it's confusing because people don't know if that's separate and apart from University of California, Berkeley, or it's all in one. So now we're just going to call it the Berkeley School of Law, and you have to tell us, why are you leaving us here from Southern California to go to Northern California?
Well, it's hard to do so. I've lived in Southern California for 30 of the last 34 years, 21 years at USC and 9 years at UCI, and being at UCI has been just an amazing experience, but I also knew that my time as dean here was coming to an end. I said that next year, my 10th year, was going to be my last. And this opportunity came along. The reality is that it's time for UCI Law School, after a decade, to reexamine itself. I'm not the one to lead that reexamination. I'm too identified with and too much part of what we've done. And so it's time for UCI to have another dean. And at the same time, I was thinking about that and thinking about what I want to do next. This amazing opportunity at Berkeley came along. So I'm sad to be leaving UCI and very excited about the new adventure.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I haven't talked to you in a while, but I was talking about some of the smartest people I know, and I mentioned you and Alan in some of the debates that you have had on this show.
Yes, you're very sweet to say that. Thank you. Yes.
I'm sure you'll take those intelligent thoughts up to Berkeley. But, you know, you have to have some mixed feelings because I know last time on the show you were so proud at the progress that UCI Law School had made. And we went over some of the statistics of the placements of the students, of the great education that the law students have been getting and how it has arisen in the public's actual knowledge of great law schools. So you leave that behind, but at the same time, you know, you have a little bit of a challenge at Berkeley because recently Berkeley has kind of dropped in some of the rating systems. I know we don't put a lot of credibility in those, but it seems that Berkeley has had a few problems over the last couple of years, and you have a little bit of a challenge to do what you did with UCI over at Berkeley.
Well, they're very different institutions. I came to UCI to be the founding dean. When I was here, there was no faculty, no staff, no students. And leave now a school that has about 50 faculty and about 450 students, and it's a very different place. I come to Berkeley, and it's a school of about 1,000 students and a very large faculty. I have a total of 450 alums at UCI, counting those who graduated on May 13th. Berkeley has 17,000 alums. So one of the things that's exciting about this is I can use what I've learned over the last 9 years, but it's also a very different experience.
Yeah, you know, I think that you really distinguish the two situations. When you look at the new situation you're getting to, is it intimidating at all? Because as you said, you know, you started with no one around you, except your wife was a professor, wasn't she, when you started UCI?
Yeah, she was a chaired professor at Duke. So the best thing that Irvine got by getting me as dean, and the best thing Berkeley will get by getting me as dean, is getting her on the faculty.
That's one way to say it. But, you know, that aside, which I'm sure is true, it must be a little bit intimidating because it's, you know, it's such an established law school where, you know, people do whatever they can to get in. And here you are, kind of the new guy in town with, of course, an incredible record. Everyone knows that. And a lot of notoriety. Is it at all intimidating?
Oh, it's very intimidating. I think one of the most important things for me is to not screw it up. It's a great school, and I need to look for the opportunities to make it better. But most of all, I need to go and spend a lot of time listening and learning about the institution. It's been there since 1895. It's got its own customs and procedures. And the first task is to become familiar with them, and then over time to try to find the opportunities that are there for me to improve its excellence.
You know, I was reading recently Maddie Miller, who's an ACUC senator-elect, an intended pre-law campus student, said, "I'm hoping that the start of his, meaning your, five-year term demonstrates leadership in the direction of integrity and scholarship so that Berkeley Law can be restored to the glory and earn the recognition its students deserve." That's kind of it's a compliment to you, but it's kind of a backhanded compliment to Berkeley when he talks, or when she talks about this direction of integrity and scholarship. What do you think she's referring to?
There's no doubt that Berkeley Law School has gone through some hard times in recent years, but when you look at the quality of the faculty and the students, it is a top law school with regard to scholarship. It is a top law school with regard to teaching. It is a top law school with regard to the students that are there. And so I think that the task that I have as dean is to maintain the excellence and to look for ways to enhance that excellence. They've had basically five deans or five interim deans over the last 5 years. I think one of the most important things that hopefully I'll bring is stability and continuity to the decision-making process. I'm just so excited about the opportunity.
Well, you've been successful at every institution you've been at.
Thank you.
Hopefully you'll be able to continue your blogging and your writing and your commentary. And how about teaching a lot of the LSAT courses? Are you still going to be able to have time with all of these responsibilities at Berkeley to do everything that you've done in the past?
Well, I'm going to obviously have to take it step by step. Some things I, of course, will continue to do. I love teaching and continue to teach while I was a dean at UCI. I'm going to teach as a dean at Berkeley. I think the most important thing for all of us as faculty is our teaching, and I think it's so important as dean that I be involved in it. And I also get to know the students in a non-decanal role. I expect to remain engaged in doing scholarship and in public commentary, writing op-eds and the like. And in terms of other things, I'm going to just have to take it step by step. So I enjoy lecturing to students getting ready for the bar exam. I'm in the midst of doing that right now. Whether I'll be able to continue to do that, I'll see as time goes on.
Well, I think it's important to the students and the future of legal education. You recently were named by the National Jurist the most influential person in legal education for 2016. So that's something that you should be proud of, obviously, and hopefully we'll be able to have the time to continue to teach and to allow people the opportunity to learn from you.
I'm still wondering. Oh, yeah. I'm still wondering if you still have those crazy attitudes and opinions about gun laws.
Do I still have crazy views on gun laws? I think it depends on your perspective. I think from your perspective, my views on gun laws are crazy. But, yeah, my views on guns are still the same. And I keep waiting for the Supreme Court to take up another Second Amendment case. Maybe they'll do it for next term.
Yeah, well, they don't right now have it on the docket. And we're going to talk about the Supreme Court. We had Alan Gura on the show a few weeks ago, or I guess a couple months ago, actually. So we had our fill of the Heller case and the McDonald cases and the Second Amendment. So you missed that. I'm sure you would have had a nice little discussion with Alan Gura, who was the lead attorney on those cases. But we have a treat for you because we do want you to have a special discussion. Some people call it a debate, but before you leave Southern California, and by the way, are you heading up there in the next month or two, or when will you be at Berkeley?
I officially begin on July 1st, and in fact, on Saturday, July 1st, the plan is my wife and I are going to get into our cars and drive and move into our new house, and I plan to be in the office on Monday, July 3rd.
That's amazing.
Are you going to be vegetarian like everybody up there? Are you going to try that?
No.
Like everybody
up there
is veggie.
Some things don't change. Yeah. And you have to maintain, you know, your integrity, of course. But that should be a great trip up there. After the break, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to discuss some of the issues of the day. We're going to talk about obstruction of justice and President Trump. We might talk about the Trump travel plan. Prop 66 in California, Supreme Court case that you wrote an interesting article on. And then, of course, we're going to get into some of the Supreme Court cases. And we don't want to just have your opinions. We have, I don't know if I can call him your nemesis, because he really isn't your nemesis.
No,
but it's your friend down the road, which I'm sure he'll miss you. John Eastman, who is the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service and former dean at Chapman University School of Law in Orange, which is just down the street from UCI. I'm sure he'll miss you, but we want to talk about these important issues because I think the both of you bring out really the important things that people need to hear about a lot of the Supreme Court decisions and some of the other things going on in our country today. So stay with us. We're going to have Erwin Chemerinsky joined by John Eastman after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KVC.
Next drive home with Jillian Barber and John Phillips. The heat wave is here in Southern California.
How hot is it?
We can all get together and discuss what it looks like to see people have Botox coming out of their pores. Lots of local, right after Dr. Drew and Mike Hathaway, right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
The following update is for drivers who pay too much for car insurance due to DUIs, DWIs, or anything else. Serenity Insurance specializes in low-cost SR22 or FR44 auto insurance. We've opened a phone line for very affordable car insurance meant specifically for overpaying high-risk drivers. The quote is free, and we'll handle the filings. Call 800-986-0694. 800-986-0694. 800-986-0694.
As a 300-foot-tall dino monster, people think all I'm good at is rampaging. But there's more to me than that. Just like Geico, yeah, they could save you money, but they also have over 75 years of savings and service. So Geico is super good at insurance. And yeah, I like rampaging. But I'm also a huge fan of Opera.
Geico. Expect great savings and a whole lot more.
How would you like to make up to $20,000 a month flipping houses with no risk? Hi, my name is Nick Vertucci, and over the last 2 years, my elite team of house flippers have flipped over 800 properties by using my three-step flipping system that guarantees quick profits. And this year, we plan to double it. I'm growing my team in your area, and I'm looking for help. I have more cash available than deals right now, so I need you. All interested candidates, call now and take an inside peek of my flipping system. I'll rush you out a free copy of my Fortunes in Flipping CD kit that will show you how easy it is to get in, get out, and get paid immediately flipping houses if you come join my team.
Call 1-800-304-1491. To get your free flipping kit, call 800-304-1491. Now, and you'll also get free tickets to a live training workshop, plus a free meal, an e-writer tablet, and a USB drive preloaded with Nick's powerful information just for attending the free training workshop. Call 800-304-1491. That's 800-304-1491. Call now.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
We are back. Hope you're enjoying your Saturday. This is Gervie's Law. I'm Alan Gervie. I'm here with Carrie Kasem, and we are speaking with the new dean of the Berkeley Law School, Erwin Chemerinsky, who, of course, is the founding dean of the University of California Irvine School of Law and known as one of the most prominent scholars of the United States Constitution in this country. And Professor Chemerinsky is joined by former dean of the Chapman University School of Law in Orange, California, now professor, the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service, John Eastman. He is also a director of the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence and associated with the Claremont Institute for the Study of Statesmanship and Political Philosophy. Professor Eastman resigned as the dean of the Chapman University School of Law to pursue the Republican nomination for the California Attorney General back in 2010. So they both have resigned from being deans. That's one thing they have in common. But I'm not sure they have a lot more in common, although they're friends. Professor Eastman, welcome back to Gervie's Law.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you. And we want to talk this afternoon a little bit about what's going on in our country. We want to talk about the obstruction of justice charges, as well as review a little bit about the Supreme Court cases that have been heard to date and that may be heard or will be heard in the future. First, let's just talk quickly about the obstruction of justice charges. Now, Professor Chemerinsky, you wrote an article, and you talked about that this, apparently to you, is fairly clear that it's obstruction of justice. Although Alan Dershowitz has said that under the Constitution, the president has the authority to direct the FBI to stop investigations of any individuals. And even in your article, you talk about that when President Trump asked the others to leave the room, we don't know what was said specifically. Also, his direction may not have been as definitive as when we look at some of the past faux pas by presidents such as Clinton with a dress or Nixon with tapes. How do you defend your opinion that this could be obstruction of justice when I'm sure Professor Eastman will say something differently?
First, obstruction of justice occurs if somebody acts with the intent of impeding a criminal investigation. So in terms of what Professor Dershowitz says, of course a president can commit obstruction of justice. Imagine that the president's best friend is being investigated and the president wants to stop the investigation entirely to protect the best friend. That would be obstruction of justice. What Richard Nixon did in 1972, telling the FBI not to investigate the Watergate burglary because it was a CIA matter, that's obstruction of justice. It's one thing if the president is setting priorities. It's another if the president is acting to impede a criminal investigation. Now, in terms of what occurred here, I think what we need is a thorough investigation by special counsel Robert Mueller. What we do have is James Comey testifying before the Senate committee saying that he felt there was, quote, direction from the president to end an ongoing criminal investigation. If that's supported by all of the evidence, that certainly would support a claim of obstruction of justice. And I would hope this isn't partisan. This isn't about whether we like or dislike Trump, whether Republican or Democrat. It's a question, did the president act impermissibly to impede an ongoing criminal investigation?
You're being such an optimist. You know that everything that we've experienced over the last few months has been mainly partisan. But Professor Eastman, how do you respond to Professor Chemerinsky?
Yeah, Irwin, with all due respect, that's just preposterous. The president, I mean, the statute about obstruction of justice, you left out the critical word. Did he interfere with an investigation with corrupt intent? There's no criminal connection of President Trump to this. There would have to be for there to be corrupt intent. Second, as the president of the United States, he has the authority to decide whether to continue an ongoing investigation or not. When he announced 2 weeks after the election in November that he would be directing that there be no investigation of Hillary Clinton, despite pretty clear evidence of criminal conduct in the handling of classified documents and pretty good circumstantial evidence of play-for-play scandal through the Clinton Foundation, I don't recall you saying that that was an obstruction of justice. And yet it was, you know, if under the terms you've set out for what qualifies as obstruction of justice, that would have been a much more clear-cut case than this one is, and nobody in their right mind would think that was obstruction of justice. So this is a political narrative that, quite frankly, I'm disappointed. You're perpetuating in a public forum. I mean, it's really ridiculous.
Well, you know, I don't know that it's that ridiculous because we're hearing it all over the place. You may be right, Professor Eastman, but I don't know that it's so different from what we're hearing. I think really the important point for both of you who are lawyers is to really look at the evidence. That's what the problem is. You're both establishing straw positions, straw man positions, straw person positions, when I think Professor Chemerinsky did say we need to look at the evidence. I think clearly you both would agree that the evidence before us right now does not rise to the level of obstruction of justice. Isn't that true, Professor Chemerinsky?
Well, let's start with the statute. And I want to quote the exact language. A person obstructs justice when he or she has a specific intent to obstruct or interfere with a judicial proceeding. In order for a person to obstruct justice, they have to have the specific intent to obstruct the proceeding. They must know that a proceeding is pending, or there must be a nexus, a connection between what the person is doing and the proceeding. So I think the question here is, did President Trump act with the intent of impeding an ongoing criminal investigation? Motive matters tremendously. I agree with John here. If President Trump was about setting priorities, we don't want to prosecute small amounts of marijuana, of course the president can set the policy. But if the president is stopping an investigation because he wants to protect a friend or protect himself, that's the very definition of obstruction of justice. And so my position is that I think that James Comey outlined some very serious charges or evidence that's credible that the president engaged in obstruction of justice. Now we need a thorough investigation.
Well, let me just say one thing, because I don't want to miss the evidence here, and I don't know if I'm missing it or not. But, you know, even in your article, Professor Chemerinsky, you talk about the February 14 meeting where Trump asked everyone else to leave the room so as to meet alone with Comey. That in and of itself, I think, is not going to provide the evidence for obstruction of justice. And then when you go on to say, I hope you can see your way clear to letting this guy go, letting Flynn go. He's a good guy. I hope you can let this go. You know, yes, we do have some implications there. But what it really means, and I'm glad you brought out intent, because you can't say the intent. Who knows what Trump was thinking or saying? Do we know?
But that's true in any criminal case where intent is an issue. The jury always has to look at all of the facts and decide from them what's the intent. The fact that he asked everybody else to leave the room might go towards intent. The words that were spoken go towards intent. The words that Trump spoke to Lester Holt from NBC, or what he said to the Russians when they were in his office, all of that's relevant for intent. I think the fundamental disagreement with John that we're expressing is he's saying that a president can never engage in obstruction of justice, and I strongly disagree with that.
I've never said any such thing, Irwin, and don't put words in my mouth, and you're reading the wrong statute. Here's Section 1505 of Title 18 of the Federal Penal Code. And again, it includes the language that you omitted. Whoever corruptly influences, obstructs, or impedes. What you're reading is a statute dealing with an ongoing proceeding in a court. This one is the one that deals with a proceeding or an investigation in an agency, which is what we have here. And the word corruptly is significant. It's what puts Richard Nixon, on the one hand, in ability to be charged with obstruction of justice. And we have no evidence, none whatsoever, not any intimation, not anything in anything Comey has said or anybody else, that there was anything corrupt about this, that it was anything other than President Trump saying in a much weaker version of what he said with respect to the Hillary Clinton investigation. I think they've suffered enough already. What he said to Comey was, it would be nice if you could see your way to letting this go. That's an exercise of proper prosecutorial discretion. And as I said, it's much weaker than the prosecutorial discretion he chose to exercise back in November, saying we're not going to investigate Hillary Clinton. That was a directive. And if this one is obstruction of justice, then that one clearly was.
You know,
and
I don't
remember you or anybody else raising the flag that that was corruption or obstruction back then.
I think, you know, what you both are proving, that evidence is really the most important thing when you look at the statute, when you look at corrupt, you look at intent. And the fact of the matter is we don't have all the information. And some of this rhetoric that from both sides is really premature. And I think that's why when you have someone like Mueller doing an investigation, that the public needs to stay quiet and let it all unfold. That's what we have these investigations, evidence. That's what we have courts for, and it's always the politics that gets in the way, and I'm going to leave it at that. I want to move on to the Supreme Court. Let's talk a little bit about the cases that have been heard or will be heard. I want to ask both of you first. We'll start with Professor Eastman. What have you seen from the 12 cases that Neil Gorsuch has been a part of the Supreme Court? Have you seen any trend that we can expect for the future?
Well, I think we've seen what most people expected, that he's a textualist and he's an originalist. And right out of the box, his very first oral argument, when he took the bench in April, he asked attorneys on both sides of the case to point him to the relevant statutory language that supported their position. And I think most people that knew Gorsuch going in or observed him during the confirmation process should not be surprised that he was so focused on that.
Now, Professor Chemerinsky, would you agree that so far we haven't seen any blockbuster cases this year, and they've mostly been focused on clarifying the law versus the highly contentious issues that we have talked about on this show before with you? We've talked about Hobby Lobby and Citizens United, Heller, Obergefell. We've talked about all those cases, but we don't seem to have any of those on the docket.
Well, there's certainly no cases this year on the docket about abortion rights or affirmative action or gay and lesbian rights or about the Second Amendment. I think there is a case where Justice Gorsuch participated in April involving religion that's going to come down sometime in the next week that could be quite important and might be a signal of a court that's shifting course with regard to the religion clauses. But there have been also some important cases that have come down. Just yesterday, the Supreme Court, without Justice Gorsuch participating, unanimously said that the trademark office can't deny registration of a trademark to an individual or to a group on account of it having disparaging language. I think that's going to be an important case. I think there's a very important case yesterday in the business area that's going to make it harder to sue corporations out of their home state. And I think it's going to be very hard for plaintiffs in certain cases to be able to sue. There was another case yesterday involving free speech that said that a state can't, as a condition for parole for a sex offender, deny the ability to use all social media. So these aren't blockbuster cases, but but they're also significant for the law and for people's lives.
I want to ask you about one of them you just mentioned, then we have to take a quick break. The so-called Slants case, the Mattel versus Tam. I don't understand why we're not just talking about where do you draw the line. In that case, the question is whether it's racially offensive speech, which is protected, and that the government refused to register the trademark for the Slants, which I believe was a band, that Asian Americans or Asians may find offensive. Where do you draw the line? What if the name, was directed at Jews in a very derogatory way or at Muslims in a very derogatory way? Isn't it just based on the actual degree of the viewpoint discrimination, as they call it?
No, I don't think so. And perhaps Sir John and I will agree. I think one of those basic principles of free speech is that the government can't punish speech or hold it liable on the grounds that it's offensive, even deeply offensive. And to deny a trademark is denying a benefit on account of the content of speech. That's why I think that all eight justices found that the law here was unconstitutional, though they disagreed in their reasoning.
John, do you have any response?
I think that's right. And we should also point out that the rock group that filed this request for the patent, the trademark of the name Slants, was itself an Asian American group. And what they were trying to do was mock the stereotypical derogatory comments about Asian Americans. And so, it just demonstrates the danger of the government getting in and making those decisions about core free speech issues.
I want to talk after the break about a case that has not been heard, Masterpiece Cake Shop, which is apparently not going to be heard by the Supreme Court. Maybe it will. It may be relisted. But we have to take a quick break. It's got interesting issues in that case. One of those more, prevalent and blockbuster type cases. We'll talk about that with Professor Shemerinsky and Professor Eastman right after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
By the time that we got up there, his room was filled with smoke.
The wind had blown and drifted the snow up against the side of my house, blocking the exhaust from my furnace.
I heard the smoke alarm going off in my friend's apartment.
Without the kid's smoke alarm, my son would not be here today.
Had it not been for that carbon monoxide detector, they would come to school and not have their teacher there.
I grabbed my fire extinguisher and put out the fire.
Kidda makes technology that saves lives.
Get these essential products at the Home Depot.
Welcome to Geico's Motorcycle Meanderings.
Oh man, this is great. I sure saved a lot of money by switching to Geico. Scored some big savings, and now I can use their mobile app 24/7 for all sorts of stuff. Life just makes sense now. You know what doesn't make sense? If a car is called a horseless carriage, why isn't a motorcycle called a horseless horse? Maybe it would just be adding insult to injury for the out-of-work horses.
Geico Motorcycle. Savings that make sense.
The thought of my sons growing up without me inspired me to quit smoking.
I talked to my doctors, and then I threw away all my cigarettes, ashtrays, and lighters.
I started exercising instead of smoking.
Staying away from alcohol when I was first quitting was key.
I kept on trying. Learn something each time.
Do whatever it takes.
No matter how many times it takes.
We did it. So can you.
For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring. Support us at 4H.org.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yes, we're back. It's Gervie's Law. We're talking to Professor John Eastman, who is the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service at Chapman University School of Law in Orange, and to Professor Erwin Shemerinsky, who is the new dean of the Berkeley Law School, also known as Bolt. Gentlemen, we were talking about some of the Supreme Court cases that have been heard, and we're going to talk about a couple that will be heard. But first, let's talk about one that will apparently not be heard. And I want to find out from you why the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, which is about Christian cake makers refusing to make cakes for a gay couple, a First Amendment challenge, has not been put on the docket. Professor Shamirinsky, do you know why, and what is your theories as to why this case, which everyone seems to be interested in, is not being heard?
I think the one place where John and I will agree on this case is we have no idea as to why the Supreme Court either has not taken the case or denied review in the case. I think the conventional wisdom would be that they're likely to deny it and somebody's going to be writing a dissent from the denial of review, and that's what's taking a long time. But we could be proven wrong on that within a couple of days when the Supreme Court takes the case, or in a couple of days if the Supreme Court denies cert without any dissent from the denial of cert. It's impossible to other than guess as to why they're taking so long without doing anything.
If they do take the case, and I'm going to put you on the spot, tell me the ruling.
Oh, I think the Supreme Court will affirm the Colorado court. It's interesting that all of the courts to deal with these kinds of issues, whether a photographer can refuse to take pictures at a gay or lesbian wedding, whether a baker can refuse to bake a cake, whether a florist can refuse to lift flowers, all of them have come down and said, you don't have the ability to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. It doesn't infringe your religion to bake a cake or take pictures or deliver flowers. And even if it did, your religion doesn't give you the right to inflict injuries on others.
Professor Eastman?
Well, yeah, I mean, Irwin may be right on the outcome. It would be 5-4 decision if that were true. I don't think anything Justice Kennedy has written previously necessarily suggest that he would go that direction. But this case, the cert petition, the request for the Supreme Court to review the case was filed all the way back last summer, in July of 2016. It's now been relisted for conference over 16 times. Now, many commentators attributed the first bunch of that to the fact that the court was split 4-4 in right. the early days. That would mean Justice Kennedy was siding with the conservatives. And that they waited, and then once Justice Gorsuch gets confirmed or nominated, you would think they would have put this on the oral argument docket for April, as they did with the Trinity Lutheran Religion case that I think Irwin alluded to earlier. And the fact that they didn't do that, and they have now relisted it another 8 or 9 times since then, is really, I think, historic. I don't think we've ever had a case that has been relisted that many times. And it's much larger time than is normally necessary for somebody to write a dissent from the denial of review. And also it doesn't make any sense if there were so few votes to grant cert in this last fall that somebody could have, that it wasn't already creating a 4-4 split. There was no reason for them not to have denied review back last fall. And sometime over the course of the fall, somebody writes their dissent from denial, and it's out. It's out. So there's something very peculiar going on here, and I don't think we have any real sense of what that is yet.
Would you agree with Professor Shamirinsky about the outcome if the Supreme Court heard?
No, I don't. If I'm right about the 4-4 split causing the long delays on this, that means Justice Kennedy's already siding with the conservatives in the case. And that means it would be 5-4 to say, you know what? You can't be forced to participate in ceremonies that you disagree with as a condition of having a job or running a small business. It might be different if Masterpiece Cake Shop was the only bakery in town, but the notion that the gay couple could not find somebody to bake their cake and therefore were injured by not being able to have a cake at their wedding is quite a stretch.
Professor Shamirinsky, let me ask you this. Why would that make a difference if you're the only cake shop in town? Aren't we talking about individual rights?
I don't think it does make a difference. In fact, I would just change the hypothetical slightly. What if Masterpiece Cake Shop said it violated their religion for there to be interracial marriage, and they wouldn't bake a cake for an interracial couple? Or an interreligious couple, would we still say they can discriminate on that basis? I don't believe that freedom of religion gives you the right to inflict injuries in that way. And so I think the reason that every court in the country to consider these issues, about photographers or bakers or florists, have come down and said, You can't discriminate. It's just the importance of enforcing anti-discrimination law.
Professor Eastman, let me just ask you this. I want to ask you a direct question. What is the difference between an interracial couple having a cake made and a gay couple having a cake made?
Well, in neither case is the discrimination because of the sexual orientation or the race. If you want to walk in and buy brownies in the bake shop, you're allowed to do so. Nobody is discriminating on the basis of that. What you're asking this person to do is to participate in a ceremony that they disagree with. Let me change the hypothetical.
But you're not participating. You're not asking them to marry them.
Hang on. You let Irwin do a hypothetical, so you're going to let me do one. Because this is another case pending out there, and it did go the other direction. Imagine an African-American Kinko's owner, and somebody comes in, a skinhead, and he wants that person to print up flyers announcing the local Klan meeting in a very anti-African-American message. Is that guy obligated to produce those flyers? And the answer is, of course not. We say that would be a violation of his own free speech rights. Well, the free speech clause is right next to the free exercise of religion clause in the First Amendment. And I don't think the two cases ought to be treated differently.
I have to say something. I haven't said a lot because I'm listening to all three of you brilliant minds talk. But I'm going to have to agree with Professor Eastman on this, because as much as I don't like these people who I find, this atrocious behavior, not baking a cake or not, taking pictures or whatever it may be, they have a right to. And you also have a right not to go to that photographer or go to that store. And I think that the repercussions could actually hurt the store more than it would actually hurt the people not having a cake, not being baked for.
Professor Chemerinsky, I remember from law school when they said bad cases make bad law. Explain why that's the case about what Carrie's talking about.
Her position would then be that a business could say, I have the right to not serve black customers, or I have the right to not serve gay customers. And the law doesn't give you that right. The law says if you run a business in California, you can't discriminate on the basis of race or sex or religion or sexual orientation. Where John's hypothetical isn't on the basis of speech not do certain things. But the law is clear in California, as it is in Colorado, that businesses can't discriminate based on sexual orientation. And I think that's why the Colorado courts came the way they did. That's why the Supreme Court would come to the same conclusion.
Well, maybe I'm wrong here, but where in any religion is you cannot feed people of different colors other than white?
Let me answer that, because this goes to the heart of the thing, and it's why Irwin's example and his attempt to equate this with blocking African-American access to a lunch counter is mischievous and false, right? Because what the bake shop here is being asked to do is to lend her creative skills to a wedding ceremony that is fundamentally contrary to her religious beliefs. It's not denying access to baked goods in her shop to anybody on the basis of their race or their sexual orientation. She is being compelled to participate in and facilitate a ceremony that is contrary to her religious beliefs. And that's where the difference is. And if we're going to say you have no religious freedom to act out your religious views just because you have to earn a living, then religious liberty no longer means anything.
All right, let's move on to Trinity Lutheran, because if we use that thought process, let's talk about then maybe the Christian school shouldn't get that playground. Of course, Trinity Lutheran is the case that talks about the state not issuing funding for a Christian school's playground. And under that reasoning, maybe you're participating, even though people say the kids playing on a playground has nothing to do with the religious school. But, it's a little bit of a stretch. Professor Chemerinsky.
So everyone knows that the case is the state of Missouri gives to schools in the state the material for the bottom of playgrounds. They take scrap tires and make a substance so that if a kid falls on the playground, there's a soft landing spot. The state gives such aid to public schools and secular private schools, but not to religious schools. The Missouri Constitution, like many state constitutions, prohibits aid to religious institutions. A religious school that didn't get the aid sued and said this was infringing their free exercise of religion and denying them equal protection. The United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit ruled in favor of the state of Missouri, and the Supreme Court is taking the case. The case was argued in April. We're awaiting decision. And I think the underlying question here is, does the Constitution require that the government give aid to religious institutions? And I think the answer to that question is no.
Professor Eastman.
I think the Supreme Court's going to vehemently disagree with that, but not as Erwin's phrased it, but as the actual issue in the case is. Can you make it a condition of getting a generally available government benefit that you forego your religious exercise? Because that's the question that's being asked. And as several of the justices explored during oral argument, does that mean that if you take Irwin's position that we could not provide police service or fire service to the campus of the church? Of course not. That would be a patently unconstitutional discrimination against the church. And this case is no different than that. We're talking about safety mats for kids on the playground. There's no connotation of religious influence here. We're not embroidering the safety mats with biblical verses from King James Bible. We're talking about the church playground being eligible for generally available grant money on the same terms without discrimination that everybody else in the state is eligible for.
Professor Chemerinsky, last word on this one, and then I have one more case I want to talk about before we let you go.
There's one Supreme Court case on point here. It's a case called Locke versus Davey. It involved the state of Washington making scholarships available to students who had excelled in high schools there who were going to college within Washington State. And the state wouldn't allow someone to use the scholarship to go to a seminary to be ordained as a minister. And the person who couldn't use the scholarship sued, just like Trinity Lutheran Church, Trinity Lutheran School, saying this is a denial of free exercise, a denial of equal protection. And the Supreme Court, 7-2, with Chief Justice Rehnquist writing, and only Justice Scalia and Thomas dissenting, said it did not violate the Constitution for the state to provide aid that could be used at secular institutions, but not at religious institutions. And I think that case is controlling here, and that's why I think that the government can choose to give money to secular institutions, but not to religious ones.
Well, we're going to wait and see how it we don't have time to talk about this anymore. I got one more case I got to ask you about, but we can always have you back after the decision comes out and you can debate who was right. Last case. This is a case that we haven't heard yet. 2 weeks ago on our show, we had Harold Gurwitz on, who represented Mr. Carpenter, Timothy Carpenter. This is the Carpenter case, which talks about protection of cell phone data that tracks detailed whereabouts of phone users. This should, and as Mr. Gurwitz said, and he's arguing with the ACLU, he's not sure whether he's going to do the argument in front of the Supreme Court or the attorney from the ACLU, but he said he thinks it will be heard in November. What is your, we'll start with Professor Eastman, what is your opinion of what will happen with this important Fourth Amendment case?
Well, the court is gradually catching up to the new technology, and in a series of cases over the last few years, it has struck down the government restrictions or the government searches or seizures or wireless or warrantless taps, tracking people using modern technology. And I suspect they're going to do the same thing here.
Professor Chemerinsky, do you agree?
I think it's a hard question, and I don't have a prediction what the Supreme Court is going to do. The Supreme Court has said that we all have a privacy interest in the content of our cell phones. This is different. This is, say, if we're out in public, can they use cellular technology to figure out where we're located? Every circuit to consider this issue has come out saying it does not constitute a search within the Fourth Amendment and rejected the position that John just took. I'd like to see the Supreme Court come out where John suggested. I just think it's a much harder question and much harder to predict.
Well, I'm glad that we finished on a very together and harmonious note, because there weren't that many. I want to thank Professor Chemerinsky and Professor Eastman. It's wonderful hearing you debate, because people can hear, the passion and also the differences in our society. And it's rather than some of the rhetoric that we hear that is not based in evidence, in constitution, in reasonableness. Both of you have points of view which we can all learn from. Professor Chemerinsky, I want to wish you all the best as you move on. to UC Berkeley, and hopefully you can come back on our show even though you're a little farther north. And Professor Eastman, thanks for being with us again. We're happy to have you on again as well, and perhaps we can have another debate between old friends. Thanks. You're listening to Gervais Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.